So today's going to be another marathon lecture. It's going to be about 2 hours. So marathon number two. And today I want to switch topics a little bit. Before I do, though, just do a quick recap of last time and I guess the material from the past week. So what have we done so far? So far, we've considered the most general renormalizable field theory. With SU2 cross U1 gauge symmetry. And empirical particle content. We've added all the renormalizable terms.
Bridges has got this textbook. I thought I remembered there being extra terms. I'd have to bring it up, but I thought there was actually extra terms where the coefficient here is experiments I've been shown to be close to zero. Like it's there is extra possible terms.
Well, we've written all things down, right? We can talk about this after the fact, but we've written down the most general renormalizable field theory. Now, not every parameter has been measured just yet. Well, in the standard model, it has been, but we can get to some subtleties after the fact. And empirical inputs. The only parameter that we haven't seen so far, where I might agree with you, would be in QCD. And so that would be the theta term of QCD, but we'll get to that next week. That might be the one, and it's related to the strong CP problem. But so far, this is the whole story. We've added all the SU2 cross U1 invariant terms that are consistent with the field content that nature told us was already there. So nothing about SU2 cross U1 symmetry told us what the fields were. That just had to be fixed by what was observed. Some of the particles that we've seen were predicted ahead of time, and the other ones had to be given the properties that we saw in the standard model because of the structure that we know it had to have. And I haven't exactly motivated why SU2 cross U1 has to be the right way to think about it. The strategy so far has been, here's a gauge theory. Let's write down all the interactions. I'll give you, by pulling out of a hat, all the field content that we need. And then from that, we can derive all the Feynman rules, and then later compare to experiment and motivate why these were good choices. And so we're almost ready to do that comparison and to really make contact with empirical stuff, but we haven't written down anything related to QCD yet. But we can write down the full Lagrangian for the standard model, but no QCD. So this, just to put it all in one place, is going to be L gauge. So these are going to be the gauge kinetic terms. There's going to be L fermion, and then there's going to be L Higgs fermion, and then there's going to be L Higgs. And this is going to be the whole story. Sometimes it'll be convenient to write things in the basis of gauge bosons that are appropriate to the original SU2 cross U1 gauge symmetry, and other times it'll be more appropriate to write them in terms of W's and Z's, but it's totally interchangeable. And let's just put these on the board step by step. So 1, 2, 3, and 4, so that we can also put them on a t-shirt. So for 1, this is most conveniently written in the basis where we look at the gauge bosons of the original SU2 and U1. So that's where we have X1 mu, X2 mu, X3 mu, and B mu. This is just to remind you what their names are. And the X's started life as SU2 left gauge bosons, spin 1 force carriers of the original SU2, and the B is appropriate to the U1Y. There were gauge couplings. Which for the SU2 we call G, and for the U1 we call G prime. And we expanded everything around the minimum of the Higgs boson's potential, and so we were able to define a mixing angle, cos theta weak G over the square root of G squared plus G prime squared. So we'll use this to trade G prime for theta weak. And so L gauge is minus 1/4 X A mu nu, X mu nu. A just sums from 1 to 3. B mu nu, B mu nu. So these are just the field strength tensors, and X A mu is del x nu, del mu x a, I should mix them, nu. The gauge coupling appears in the kinetic term of the non-abelian field strength, ABC. This is the structure constant of SU2. And we write down the nonlinear term. I should have written this as mu nu. So if it's got two indices, it's the field strength tensor. If it's just got one index, it'll be the gauge boson. This is conventional notation, unfortunately. Del mu that's the gauge sector, and we defined W bosons after electroweak symmetry breaking, which were 1 minus plus IW2. These are X's. And we defined a Z boson in the, since we're trading G prime for theta, we can define a Z mu as it's going to be cosine theta weak times X mu minus sine theta weak B mu, and a photon, which is massless, as the other linear combination. So theta weak B mu plus cos theta weak X mu. Okay, and so this is the photon. And this covers all the gauge interactions. To get the standard model form of these gauge interactions, just solve for x1, x2, x3, and b in favor of w, a, and c, and then just rewrite these terms, and then all the gauge boson self-interactions arise. I want to put this explicitly on the, this, you're right, because this should have been an X mu. This is a typo. Thank you. And so the idea is you just make a substitution of these definitions into this form. And then you notice that the nonlinear terms, the term, say, that involves the bilinear of X's, is now going to give rise to non-trivial interactions between the W's and the Z's and the photon. So that's all for L gauge. That's enough to write down all the gauge boson interactions that exist all by themselves. So L fermion. So we saw that this had to be minus I fermion dagger del mu fermion. And the fermions were, we had doublets. And singlets under SU2. Is there a question? Oh, I should have had a plus minus, thank you. Good. So we defined some doublets that were fermions. The doublets we had were L. They carry a flavor index, so I is electron, muon, or tau. We defined a quark doublet with a flavor index where I for quarks is up, it's 1, 2, or 3, and the first generations can be up or down, second generation can be charm or strange, and the third generation can be top and bottom. And of course, each QI is U left, D left, I. So that the first one has this pair, but they're both left-handed. Second one has that pair, and so on. And we had a bunch of SU2 singlets, which were the Dirac partners of the fields that show up in this interaction. And the SU2 singlets, we gave the funny notation. I'll write them in a generation generic way. So this for the leptons, E mu tau, just say this. So we had ECR, mu CR, and tau CR. For the quarks, we had something similar, but one for each kind of quark. So for every down type quark, so now I can be down, strange, bottom. And UCR, where this can be up, charm, and top. Okay? And depending on whether you're a doublet or a singlet, your gauge covariant derivative looks a little different. So d mu del mu minus I g square root of 2 w mu plus W mu minus T minus IG over cosine theta weak Z mu T3 minus Q hat sine squared theta weak minus I QE A mu. Okay. So this is for doublets, well, this is for everybody. Remember, but T plus minus 1/2 sigma 1 plus minus I sigma 2 acts only on doublets. Or things that carry, well, things that started life in doublets regardless of how we choose to reorganize them later on. And the same is true for, also true, for T3. Your T3 charge is whether it tells you whether you started life in the upper component or in the lower component of a doublet. And there's L. Higgs fermion. So L. Higgs fermion is what gave masses. Masses and their Dirac masses to fermions. And we had three kinds of interactions like this. We had a matrix for leptons. And now I'm writing it diagonally in flavor space because we have the freedom to do that. So this is diagonal in flavor space. There's H dagger. Li and ECRI. This is the gauge invariant combination of a Higgs doublet, a lepton doublet, and a right-handed, an ECR. There's going to be similar structure for the down type quarks, still diagonal. Higgs is going to carry the dagger. There's going to be a quark doublet, so this is a flavor index. This is the down type Yukawa matrix, which is diagonal in the basis that we've chosen. And there's going to be an up type So an uptype Yukawa matrix where the Higgs is now contracted with the beta with an epsilon tensor. So these are SU2 indices. Putting them together with an epsilon tensor makes an SU2 invariant object, and multiplying on UCR makes sure that this operator in composite form has the right hypercharge. But there are flavor indices on these things, and they're diagonal in the basis that we've chosen. So in mass diagonal basis, W quark interaction has the CKM matrix. V CKM, which acts on flavor indices. And that's the whole story. So I haven't, for SU2 cross U1, I haven't written down, or I haven't omitted any operator that I could have written down. We've rotated some away because we had the gauge freedom, or the rotational freedom to just change bases, do field redefinitions. But everything's here. And now the only one left to remember is L Higgs, which is just the potential of the Higgs. So this is the Higgs doublet. We gave it a mass term that had the wrong sign. And the wrong sign mass meant that the potential that we would naively think is the potential is not really the true minimum of the theory. Well, the minimum that we would naively expect at zero is not really a minimum, but it's a local maximum. So H equals 0, 0 is local maximum. And H is the true minimum. The true minimum and the Higgs potential when we expand it, well, I'll leave it in capital H.
I think you're missing a couple squares on
there. Yes, I am. Thanks.
Also on the derivative.
I am. Good. And so the minimum here is at the value V, which we can always rotate, can put in bottom component. Okay, because of SU2, with an SU2 left U and Y gauge transformation. Okay, so far so good. So what are the parameters? So how many things do you need in order to say that you've written down the standard model theory? Some of the parameters are related to each other. So the Higgs-Vev is mu over the square root of lambda up to a factor of 2, which I don't care to write down properly. We know that the Higgs-Vev has the numerical value 246 GeV. Now we know that because MW is G times V. It's over 2. And we know G from other processes. Mainly because it shows up every time a particle that we know and love decays, and so we get G. We know the mass of the W, which has just been produced and measured. And so we can figure out what G is. We've known what V is for a really long time. The only thing that was learned when we discovered the Higgs, so with discovery, we now know that lambda is, I think, 0.2 or something along those lines. But you just solve for it knowing that this is 246 and that this can be related to the mass of the Higgs. So the parameters of the theory are MW, MH, which is really a measure of lambda. So MH can be rewritten after you've expanded this. There's going to be a term that looks like the mass of the little Higgs, because what I should have done is said that here we've got V plus H. This is the physical Higgs field, and we're just writing it as a field called little h that has minimum at 0 plus the vacuum expectation value. Root lambda times V. This is G times V over 2. MZ is MW, well, I should say that MW is MZ times cosine theta W. So cosine theta W is another input. So we need to know this, we need to know this, and this. So these have all been measured. Once you have the mass of the W, you know what the weak mixing angle is. You also know it from its appearance in various decay processes, which can be calculated and then measured. You need to know the Yukawa matrix. Well, you need to know the Yukawa diagonal entries. So these are going to be three parameters for YU, YD, II for each of these. And for the leptons, so three of each of those. And so these are related to the masses of the fermions, because the mass of any fermion is the Yukawa coupling of that fermion times the Higgs VeV over the square root of 2. So we can think of either the masses as being the input parameters or as the Yukawa matrices. We had G and G prime, but we traded these for G and the electric charge times cosine theta W. This is also just a QED parameter. So on this list, we have to have G, we have to have cosine theta W, and we need to have E. And finally, we need to have VCKM. Okay. And I forget exactly how many parameters are free in the CKM. Oh, yeah?
Four.
Four in the CKM? Ah, great. Okay, so four param. Okay. And that's the whole story. So once you've measured each of these things experimentally, so measure these are the inputs, and then make an infinite number of predictions. And in 40 years, people have been trying to break the standard model, and they haven't yet. So it's all consistent right up until last year with the discovery of the Higgs. So the only thing we learned last year was, or 2 years ago, was the value of lambda. Everything else was already fixed by things that had been measured before.
Sometimes you hear people say that the standard model has X number of parameters, free parameters, but it depends on how you count. And I never really know what you mean when you say that. Do you?
The basis that you choose is not unique, but the number of parameters is well defined.
Pretty sure I've heard that number of times. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the SU2 cross U1 symmetry tells you what the gauge couplings are, and then you start adding free parameters once you start turning on fermion interactions. So you give representations to the fermions, and then that tells you what the couplings are. These will be some things that depend on the sines and the cosines of the weak mixing angle. The number of Higgs particles you have determines what the structure of the vacuum is. If there's only one, that puts the V downstairs. And this structure also ensures that the W and the Z have this kind of relationship with each other. And then the number of families that you've added tells you how many free parameters you'll ultimately have in the CKM once you've rotated all your fields. So as it stands, this is the complete list.
Yeah, it seems clear. I just don't understand why another question is, the four parameters in the CKM matrix, are these really or complex?
So one is complex. And the existence of an irreducible complex phase means that there's the possibility of CP violation. Okay. So charge conjugation and parity simultaneously performed are violated in interactions where the phase arises. The phase is an artifact of having a 3x3 matrix instead of a 2x2 matrix. So that was why Kobayashi and Misukawa shared a Nobel Prize in 2009. Because back in the 70s, they argued that if you had a 3x3 structure, you'd have the possibility of CP violation, and then it was observed. And up until that point, it was thought to be an exact symmetry of the standard model. And so, yes?
Observed.
It was observed in the 70s, actually. It was a while ago. So this has already been a lot of notation. In QCD, once you develop the formalism of bound states and how to talk about mesons and how to separate long distance and short distance degrees of freedom because they're confined, once that formalism is developed, then you can study things like mesons oscillating from one kind into another kind, and the properties of those oscillations can be related to the possibility of CP violation. So that was observed in the K-on system. And if you're curious, just Google KK bar mixing. It's the only system that's been observed to demonstrate CP violation. And it's a rare process, because if you don't have it when it's just a 2x2 matrix, if two generations in the standard model wouldn't give you CP violation, then that tells you that any process that actually involves the irreducible phase has to involve all three generations. Because otherwise, you could always just change the definition of the CKM matrix for whatever 2x2 process you're considering and rotate it away. So you need all three generations. So that's why these things are rare. And so typically, it means loop diagrams. So you'll have some sort of quark and some sort of anti-quark in a meson. And then there's a complicated diagram in here where all three generations participate. So there's VCKM from all parts of the matrix. And then you oscillate into a Q bar prime, Q prime. And these have different flavor structure, potentially. And the rate of this oscillation. So you produce the particle, and it lives for a certain amount of time, but then it oscillates before it decays, and then it decays into something else. It's a rich subject. I'm not going to do it any justice, so I'm not going to try, but this is all I want to say about it. That's the observation of CP violation in the standard model. And I think that might be a good place to stop for the standard model. So the only thing we haven't done yet is talk about QCD. And I'm not going to do that today, because to do it, we have to talk about the running of the QCD coupling constant. So we have L standard model is what I've called, so L gauge plus L fermion plus L fermion Higgs plus L Higgs plus L QCD. So we haven't seen anything about this yet. So this will be discussed next week. Mainly because unlike the other particles or the other interactions that we've seen so far, everything in QCD is confined. Confined, and that there's another parameter, G strong. So this is the SU3 coupling constant. Which would be another input parameter in the theory. And that's the only input parameter that we're going to add by introducing QCD, because all of its interactions are fixed by the value of this parameter. because it's an unbroken gauge symmetry, and SU3 is unbroken, in that there's no analog of the Higgs mechanism. But the strong coupling constant, true to its name, is of order one, and it runs. And so we'll make that a little more precise. But the idea is that physical parameters depend on the energy scale that you're considering in the process through the virtual corrections introduced by loop diagrams. Those loop diagrams will shift the values of physical parameters through renormalization. And the strong coupling constant has the peculiar property that it gets stronger at lower energies, which is why at really high energy colliders, you can actually make gluons, you can make quarks, but only for a period of time that's short enough to correspond to the time scale at which it becomes strong again. So it's stronger at lower energies, it's weaker at high energies, at higher energies or temperatures. And so in the very early universe, back when the temperatures were above the characteristic energy of confinement, which is many orders of magnitude what we see in stars and so on, back then the ambient temperature of any two quarks, because the universe was very hot and very dense, when the temperature was above lambda QCD, so this is lambda QCD, which is not an independent parameter, this depends on G strong, so this is some function of G strong. When the temperatures are above lambda QCD, then quarks and gluons are free particles. Okay. So now I'm only going to say things about QCD in broad generalities because we really want to talk about running couplings. Running couplings, and so that means we have to talk about renormalization. And so that'll be the topic of the rest of this lecture. And it's a marathon lecture, so we'll have a little bit of time, but it's certainly not enough time to do the program of renormalization any sort of justice. So what I'll attempt to do today is give a heuristic overview of what that means in simpler cases. So, and then we're going to consider the example of QED renormalization. And specifically, the photon self energy. So this is my goal for today. If I get through this, then the payoff, which might have to wait till Monday, depending on how much ground can be covered, though I don't want to rush it, so whatever happens, happens. But the payoff is going to be that we'll see the QED coupling constant depend on energy by determining the beta function of QED. Okay. All right, so that's where we're headed. So the main goal is just to set up the discussion that we'll need to have next week about how gauge couplings run, how to do calculations. And I can't do the calculations in any real kind of detail, but I don't want to skip any steps, so I'm just going to outline the calculations that we'll see. So let me just put a 1, a 2, and a 3. Okay. So renormalization is not really anything unfamiliar. So we've already seen it. totally seen it in a very mundane way in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So we've seen an analog of it in non-relativistic quantum mechanics in perturbation theory. And so it's not in any way strange to imagine that in regular quantum mechanics, so there's some Hamiltonian operator, and it acts on a wave function, psi of x, and it gives back some eigenvalue of that wave function. So this is just a non-relativistic wave function. And there's some problems that we can solve exactly. So we solve a simple problem. Say we solve the infinite square well. And so what that gives us is a basis of eigenstates. Say psi n that satisfy this for the Hamiltonian operator of our simple problem. But then we're not satisfied, so we want a harder problem. So we do perturbation theory. Where I can call phi the exact wave function. And we want to write down h, which is h0 plus, or I should say simple, one that we can solve exactly. Plus h int. So there's some perturbation that we add. And then this, we've solved exactly with our basis set psi sub n. We want to know what phi is. So h plus h int simple. Acting on phi is now going to give back eigenvalues on phi. So I'm going to say, I'm going to index them with n. Or maybe I'll index them with m just to avoid confusion. Easy to fix that. So now we build these solutions in perturbation theory. Build approximate phi m. Using perturbation theory. And then we write down phi m is some linear combination, n out to infinity, cmn psi n for the simple set. Functions that are diagonalized by h. Okay? So far, so good. This is familiar to everybody. But phi are not properly normalized. So they're not properly normalized. Most zeroth order questions that we ask about them don't really matter so much. We started off with a normalized set of psi n. But then in building these linear combinations, we didn't necessarily preserve the normalization of the basis that we ended up with after the fact. And so we have to impose by hand a new normalization on the phis. So we fixed this by hand just by rescaling these fields. And only after we've refixed it, so only afterwards, does our theory make sense. The criterion for making sense in the context of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and so making sense in this case means probability is conserved. Okay, so if probability is conserved when my wave functions are properly normalized, I do this by hand, and after I've done it by hand, the theory is fine. So what's the analog of this program in quantum field theory? In quantum field theory, it's no different in some sense. Okay, so how does this work? So recall that from the very beginning, in the beginning, the thing that we start with is phi of x, and it's, say, a free scalar theory. It's a free scalar field. Okay, so now it's not a quantum mechanical wave function, it's just some free scalar field. And we solve it exactly. We solve it exactly because the simplest non-interacting free theory exactly soluble. And I don't have to write down any Feynman diagrams. I don't have to do any loop calculations to figure out exactly what the form of phi is so that it has all the right properties. That's the thing where you expand in terms of exponentials and creation and annihilation operators, and we've all seen it. So it's exactly soluble, and our observables are time-ordered correlation functions. Okay. And so what we care about are objects of the following form. So it's a correlation function from vacuum to vacuum. All the scattering amplitudes will ultimately be built out of this object. But in the free field theory, it's just something. So I can define it in the following way. Well, you actually solve for it, but for now, just take this as a definition for the purposes of this lecture. Px, d4x. So I'm just going to write it in terms of its Fourier transform. And we found a long time ago that this was equal to p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. The I epsilon, just to remind us about causality, tells you which way to close contours to make sure that the commutator of space-like separated fields vanishes. Not super important for the rest of this lecture, but I include it for completeness. And the important thing is that at the pole, the residue is I. Pardon? Oh, I do. I forgot I'd written it. Okay, I don't need two of them. Good. Okay. So the caveat in all of this, or it's not really a caveat, I guess it's really more of a subtlety. The subtlety is that zero is the free vacuum. And for the purposes of this lecture, I just want to dissociate the word vacuum from everything that we've said about the Higgs. So that's it's the same kind of vacuum. I'm just going to just think back to the first chapter of any quantum field theory textbook. This is just something that creation and annihilation operators act on. Okay, in the usual sense, it's just the vacuum state, the state of zero particles, however we got it. Okay. And what we need to do in order for our usual understanding of propagators and Feynman diagrams to hold water is to make sure that the pole of this thing is defined at I. So we know how to work in this free field theory. Okay, so I'm going to start over here. Okay. So we know how to calculate in this theory. But this theory sucks. So this theory is boring. This theory is boring because there are no interactions. Okay? And if there are no interactions, we want to do something similar to the case of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So let's add them. So add interactions. So when we add interactions, what we're doing is taking, we think of things in terms of actions now. So there's some action, which is d4x l3 plus l perturbed. Okay. The free part only ever contains field bilinears. Field bilinears with correct kinetic term coefficients. Okay. And only after we have the full theory written out with this condition satisfied do we have any right to talk about propagators and Feynman diagrams and so on. Now, the reason this doesn't come up early on, we'll see later that even after interactions are turned on, even after L-int is non-zero, this is still okay. Well, even after this thing is turned on, we don't have to worry about any subtleties. Don't worry at tree level. Okay. But at loop level, this starts to matter. At loop, okay. All right. So let's consider a simple example of what might happen. So example now, let's talk about an interacting field. Interacting field phi. Notice that it's exactly the same field as in the interacting theory. We're just adding new terms to the Lagrangian. So it's the same object. But I want to put a superscript on top of that just to remind us that this was defined in free theory. And that's a very bad way of writing it. But the superscript is just going to remind us that this thing started life as something that we obtained by doing free field theory, where before we turned on interactions, we had an I at the residue of our propagator for this field. Now, the field phi's the vacuum state is not the vacuum of the theory anymore. And the usual expansion in terms of creation and annihilation operators is going to be different because that was a solution to the free problem. And so now we have to think a little more carefully about how to define the propagator. So the interacting vacuum we're going to define as this thing called omega. Okay? And we want to make sure, ensure by hand that the residues of the propagator among other things. So there are going to be other conditions too. We want to ensure that the residue of this propagator is still I at p squared goes to m squared. Okay. I'm running out of room. Okay, well, we're going over here now. All right. So from here to over there to over here. Okay. So what is the propagator? So just, so is this clear so far? Are there questions?
What do you mean by correct?
I just mean that in order to get the usual form of this thing, we had to start with the Lagrangian that had, well, actually, I'll do it right here. So we started off in the free theory with, for a real scalar field, del mu phi, del mu phi, right? The coefficient of this thing is 1/2. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what we're going to do is take the solutions that we've built out of the free theory and apply them to the case of the interacting theory. And this might not hold anymore once we do that naively, in the same way that normalization of normal quantum mechanical wave functions might not hold after you build a perturbed solution out of a non-perturbed solution. And so we have to check that once we do this, once we start calculating things in an interacting theory, that this condition is still satisfied. And we have to, if needed by hand, make sure that that remains the case. Otherwise, we're not talking about physical things anymore, because we wrote down propagators, and maybe those Feynman diagrams contain divergences, but really those were unphysical because we didn't have the right normalization of this thing in the first place. So that's something to keep in mind. Okay, so what is the propagator in the interacting case? Can everyone see this beyond the podium, by the way? No? Okay, so in the interacting case, we can write down the same propagator, d4x e to the I p dot x phi of x phi 0. And now, generically, it might not be 1 anymore, because we've built this. So here we used free solutions of phi of x acting on a different vacuum. On different vacuum omega, which is not the vacuum where we know it has the right normalization. Okay. And so keeping the I epsilon reminds you that that when p squared goes to m squared, that this is actually a pole, and that we're interested in getting this residue, right? So how do we restore sanity to the theory? We restore sanity by hand, divide by z. Okay. So now I want to consider this object, d4x e to the ipx, phi of x, phi 0. And I'm going to suggestively put a square root of z under each one of these things. And so now this has the right propagator. Okay. And we can define a renormalized field. Um, this just reminds us that it's renormalized. I understand the potential confusion because so far we've been dealing with fermions and whether they're left-handed spinners or right-handed spinners. So that's just gone from the conversation. Right now, from here on out, I will say absolutely nothing about left-handed versus right-handed spinners. This is just a scalar field and the little r's to remind us that we're defining it to be the renormalized version of the original field, z phi of x. And I'll put a zero subscript to remind us that this is what started life as what's called the bare field that showed up in the original Lagrangian. Okay, and so maybe this is a good place to pause and maybe take a 15-minute break. So I guess we should all just meet back here at 10:10.